This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation Pop Network. We once again gather around the campfire to tell stories about our favorite movies. And this week, we've got a couple of good ones. So I'm glad you could join us. I'm one of your grateful co-hosts, Chris Jordan. You can find me online at RetroMovieNerd.com, where this week, I delve into the horror realm, the 80s horror realm. There's no finer realm to dive into than the 80s horror realm. And I've got a review of the original, the first, Friday the 13th. And so check it out. It's coming this week, RetroMovieNerd.com, probably at the time that you're listening to this. And I've also got another weekly column called What Am I Watching This Week?, where I continue to burn my bridge with Netflix and looking for cinematic streaming options elsewhere. And I've hit on a treasure trove of doozies on Amazon Video. And I go into detail in that column every week. Just this past week, I've watched a Jackie Chan movie, New Fist of Fury, which was a sequel to Bruce Lee's Fist of Fury. And there was also a horror film, a little forgotten kind of a gem called Alice, Sweet Alice. It was quite a good film. And then you can also find a doozy on there like The Mighty Peking Man. Which is just basically a Chinese King Kong from beginning to end, really. It's just one big Chinese-style King Kong ripoff. So look for that column every week at RetroMovieNerd.com. Joining me, as always, my partner in crime, the main storyteller in these parts. He is the Ayatollah of pop cultura. That makes him Joel LaPuma.
And thank you for that, Chris, but I don't know, you might be supplanting me. You're the one guesting on all these wrestling podcasts.
I gotta give us a plug somewhere, right? And you know, we just did a TLC recap on Scott Criscolo's Main Event podcast. He and brother Nate Milton are the hosts of that show, and it was a pleasure to be on that show, and I thank them for the opportunity to give us the plug.
Yeah, and you can find me at Razor Candy at razor-candy.com. And the more enterprising among you might have seen me at Chiller Fest this past weekend.
Yeah, Chiller Fest. So how'd that turn out, Joel?
Chiller was great. They had a Nightmare on Elm Street 3 reunion with most of the Dream Warriors present. They had actually like a Burning reunion, Creepshow 2, Night of the Comet, and Last Starfighter. A lot of cool stuff this year. Chiller Tank, for those of you in the Northeast, it's in New Jersey twice a year. And it's not just a horror convention. Of course, it's named after Chiller Theater with Zach Early, the recently departed Cool Ghoul. You know, classic horror host, but the convention is largely like sort of a wider pop culture convention. I mean, you know, there's horror movie stars, but there's you'll often see people from The Sopranos or Sons of Anarchy, even Walking Dead. I mean, Walking Dead is horror, but it's so widespread. It doesn't even feel like a horror community thing. People from classic television. You know, there was a big panel for Robert Fuller, star of Emergency, and a number of other old TV dramas. A lot of westerns, Laramie, that kind of thing. But it's a really wide reaching festival. I mean, there's a lot of old sitcom stars there. I think Mike Nesmith from The Monkees was there this year.
Oh, no shit.
Gilbert Gottfried was there. He's been there a few times.
They had a fucking monkey?
They had a monkey. No, it's a very wide range. They had probably more horror this time around than they have in the past, with those like full reunions of like The Burning and Dream Warriors. You know, Paul Eller's Madman Mars himself was there. They had a lot of horror there this convention, because it's twice a year. So a lot of good stuff. And you know, shout out to the guys at Vinegar Syndrome, who we love to mention in our upcoming releases segment, because their booth was there. Brandon, who works the booth, is really fun to talk to, really knowledgeable. I picked up a copy of the Ed Wood written Orgy of the Dead, so I can't wait to see how that looks. It's on Blu-ray.
Yeah, title alone, it sounds quite awesome. You've got an orgy, and you've got some dead.
You got Criswell, and the cover is really sort of psychedelic, bright colors. Just a phenomenal design. They've been doing great stuff with their slip covers on the past releases. Like we mentioned, might have been even last week mentioned, the releases of Bloodbeat and Demon Wind. Demon Wind has like a lenticular cover, like you'd see on a lot of comic books in the 90s or trading cards in the 90s, and it looks awesome.
Great. It sounds like a fun time.
Oh, and, absolutely.
Yeah, so that's probably something anyone of our listeners out there on the East Coast in the tri-state area, I know there's quite a few of them, you know, that's probably something they want to check out when next time it rolls into town.
Yeah, it's definitely worth a look. It is very crowded, especially since they changed. They've had it at a couple different hotels. The one they're at now is decently sized, but it's a lot of small rooms and the hallways are kind of narrow, so there's a lot of congestion, unfortunately. And partly because it's a fairly sizable convention. It still never approached the level of congestion it did when they had Norman Reedus and John Bernthal there.
Oh, shit. I'm surprised the place didn't burn down to the ground.
Yeah, I remember the wait for Norman Reedus I had heard was like 5 hours or something like that.
Oh, my gosh. And I'm sure it was 90% female.
It was. I mean, you know, he's got tons of fangirls, obviously, because, you know, I think I can believe in a zombie horde. I can't believe a backwoods redneck is that hot.
So, very cool, Joel, and thanks for sharing that with us. Appreciate it, and of course, to our listeners still on the East Coast, you may want to stay tuned for next week, because we're going to have a special show next week. I say next week, but our next episode will be centered around the hugely popular Hudson Horror Show. We'll have one of the founders of the show on the show with us. So keep listening for that. That should be a good time.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll be talking about the origins of the festival, the way a big film show like that is produced, the specific films they're going to be playing for the upcoming show, which is their 16th major show. They've got a lineup of Halloween 4, Blackula, Savage Streets, Prison, and The Boogings.
Yeah.
I particularly can't wait for The Boogings. But We'll be talking about those next week. It should be a really fun discussion, and different a bit different than our usual structure.
I'm going to ask if they've ever shown Death Spa.
Unfortunately, not. But everyone should show Death Spa.
Yeah, I'm still going to ask.
Maybe you go for it. Maybe like right alongside or Robicide.
Yeah. Great. Awesome. All right. So let's roll ahead then, Joel. Let's get into the new release segment here. New releases this coming week. Halloween releases, October 31st, the release date for these Blu-rays and DVDs that we're going to hit you up with here. You have to pick and choose because we got some good ones coming out this week. Let's start with a couple from Olive Films, a couple of classics from the 40s. The first one we want to talk about is Return of the Ape Man with Bela Lugosi and John Carradine. And of course, the premise of this is that a caveman is found frozen in the Arctic on an expedition. And he's taken back to civilization, and he's thawed out, and they decide to do some brain surgery on him. That's always a genius move. Swap out a brain, and then, of course, that's probably where everything goes to hell. But, Return of the Ape Man. You got any thoughts on Return of the Ape Man, Joel?
It's not one I've seen. I looked into the director, Phil Rosen, who is a very early director. His first, his first film was something like 1915. I mean, you know, he has nearly a 40-year career. I think he's probably best known for directing at least a half dozen Charlie Chan films in the 40s. But, you know, very long, successful career. I mean, he's got nearly 150 directorial credits. It's just an interesting bit of film history. I'm not sure how good it's going to be, but I am curious about the film itself. It looks fun and interesting. And also, what is it about Bela Lugosi being matched up with apes? I mean, I keep thinking of Bela Lugosi meets a Brooklyn gorilla.
Yeah, I don't know, man. Maybe there's some kind of like direct link between man and ape. I don't know, Joel.
I guess if you
we're going to have to break down evolution for people here on this show. I don't really want to do that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm safe up here in the Northeast, man. You're in Texas. You have fun talking about evolution down there, but Bela is one of the sort of, I guess, earliest Hollywood examples of typecasting. And it's not one, I don't think it's a situation where I don't think he was able to roll with it very well. I mean, there's plenty of reasons for that, including his drug addiction. But, especially after the height of the Universal boom, like, he got stuck in so much low rent stuff. And it's interesting to see him in that stuff, but it's also kind of sad.
He may have been an early example of a guy who was in it for the paycheck.
Oh, I have no doubt. I mean, he's someone who, he's an interesting case to me because he's someone who like sort of had an idea of how to like build the. Of course, he had a lot of mystique, and he had like a persona, and he had an idea of how to like use that persona, but maybe it's just that, the nature of interacting with the media was so different in the first half of the century that like now, if you were had that kind of like ongoing persona, you could just run with that forever to relative success. For Bela, I think it ended up being kind of an albatross at the same time.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, if Tim Burton's film Ed Wood is to be taken literally, Bela Lugosi was really just, especially towards the end, was just, I guess, a sad caricature of his former self. And But I mean that's another story entirely. So.
It's always, I guess, not to derail our new releases too much, but it's always interesting to me. Like, of course, you bring up Burton. If anybody, like, in the modern era has been accused of, like, repeating himself and just sort of getting lost in his persona, which I think is a little unfair towards Tim Burton, but, I mean, the accusation is certainly present with a lot of his films, especially some of his later day, like, Johnny Depp releases, who is another person who's sort of gotten lost in his persona, much to his detriment. I mean, Burton seems like his life is fairly stable, and Depp is obviously not.
Yeah, so there's quite the rabbit hole to go down there as far as that's concerned. So, but let's look at this other Olive Films release called from 1945, The Vampire's Ghost. And I've never seen it, but looking it up, it's basically, it looks like there's a bar down in Africa, in deep, dark Africa, that's run by a vampire. And that's about all I got for it, Joel.
Yeah, it's based on a fairly classic short story, The Vampire, spelled Vampyre by John William Polidori. I think it's generally considered like it's even a precursor of Dracula, if I believe. It's like the first romantic vampire film, a vampire story. So it's a. I don't think it's going to be anything like this movie, but you know, this is another curiosity. Haven't seen it. The director, Leslie Solander, probably his best work was as an assistant. I mean, he's a guy with also like 100-150 credits, but you know, he probably has his biggest success as an assistant director. He worked on A Night at the Opera, Fury by Fritz Lang. He directed a lot of successful stuff, especially westerns in the 40s and 50s. But yeah, it's kind of hard to compare to Night at the Opera. But he also did like a ton of TV, Lassie, Laramie. I mean, especially for a director working in westerns as much as he did, television was like nothing but westerns in the 50s.
Oh, yeah, that's right. There's just like some kind of Western Renaissance or whatever going on in the 50s and early 60s. It even went so deep into the comic book realm as well, because superheroes kind of fell by the wayside after they were introduced in the late 30s and 40s. And really, Western comics suddenly became very popular. I mean, it was everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, like those sort of down-to-earth genres, like Western, westerns, war, romance comics, and of course horror comics before the Seduction of the Innocent hit. Like those were what was keeping comic books afloat, aside from the few holdover superheroes who had survived, like Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman. But I mean, like that genre was so all-encompassing that it burned itself out. Like by the end of the 50s, I mean, there were barely any westerns on TV except for some, you know, long runners like Gunsmoke. By the end of the 60s, they were pretty much dead.
Yeah, and who knows? Maybe that'll happen to the superhero genre in this age. Eventually, it'll burn itself out. Hey, that's another story for another show as well. So we've got several rabbit holes we can go down here, Joel.
I know.
So, but let's move on, and let's grab a new release from Lionsgate. It's 1986. This is a movie that we got a brief mention in Stump Joel on the last episode. It's Slaughter High from 1986. Basically the premise, you've got a kid who was a bullying victim. There was an accident. He gets disfigured, and then several years later, he returns to get his murderous revenge.
Yeah, this is a really goofy, dumb, fun slasher film. I mean, probably the greatest thing it has going for it is Caroline Monroe in a lead role. It's not good, but it's really fun and has some wonderfully wonderfully goofy, stupid kill scenes.
Basically the horror genre in the 80s. I mean, you were getting like dozens of these movies pumped out in any number of year in the 80s, and to stand out, something like Slaughter High to stand out, it has to be some sort of goofy fun in order to be remembered.
Yeah, it pretty much is that. It's goofy fun. It's completely dumb. I think at one point it was titled April Fool's Day, but the actual April Fool's Day beat it to the punch. And this is part of Liongate's release of various Vestron home releases from the 80s.
Vestron video, yes, sir.
So I think the Blu-ray for this, as well as some of the other ones they've done recently, Waxwork, things like that, have had the Chopping Mall, have had the Vestron logo on it.
Yeah, I love Vestron video. They were the kings of B-movie horror, sci-fi, it's just one of those eras and that's what we based the premise of the podcast on originally, was just talking about movies just like this. And Vestron Video, Wizard Video, there were several different distribution companies in the 80s that were responsible for stuff like this, and it was just something you don't see anymore.
Oh yeah, I mean, it was the video store, but store boom. Stores needed, and of course, a lot of these films. Vestron was not really a dealer initially in straight to video, so a lot of these films were theatrical releases. But video stores needed product, and horror was a thriving job. It's like any home format. The biggest genres are horror and pornography.
Oh, pornography. Oh. Anyway,
it's just like the two things you either are too young to go to the theater to see or don't want to be seen going to the theater to see.
Yeah, every video store had that little velvet curtain in the back of the store. we got a Severin release this week, Joel. 1975's The Devil's Reign.
Yes.
I have a copy of this, a different copy. I haven't sat down to check it yet, so I don't know what the quality is. But this is the first time that this film has been released in HD, which is it sounds pretty awesome. Now we've got who do we have? We've got William Shatner in here. Ernest Borgnine. Hey, John Travolta makes an appearance. I think his face melts in this.
It does. His appearance, when the film came out, his appearance was hyped up. He was put higher up in the credits. But no, absolutely. He's not in much of it. It just so happens that the film's release happened to coincide with him becoming well known to Welcome Back, Kotter.
Yeah, exactly. It was Welcome Back, Kotter, his early fame there. This is pre-Saturday Night Fever, John Travolta. So he was just on the rise at the time. But yeah, you've got a devil-worshipping cult in here. and, of course, you can't go wrong with Ernest Borgnine in a devil-worshipping cult movie. So yeah.
And we've also got, I believe, Tom Skerritt from Alien is in it.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that's right. Yep.
And it is
a star-studded cast.
It is. I've seen it in theater. It's a great, it's a really great film. I mean, it's dumb and fun, but it's got a nice spooky atmosphere. I mean, the cast throws themselves into it, especially Ernest Borgnine. I mean, Ernie just really just chews it up. It's wonderful.
Definitely one that I think of all the movies on the list, that's probably the one I would recommend highest for this week's releases anyway. But then we've got a couple more. These are from Blue Underground, and they both share the same thing. 1983's The Lift from 2001, Down, but it's probably better known as its alternate title, The Shaft. And what's the central theme in both of these films, Joel, if they haven't figured it out already?
Killer elevators, baby.
Killer elevators, dude. One is Dutch, the other one's not. So there's a difference between the two.
But they do have the same director.
Interesting enough, they
do have the same director, Dick Moss, who, and they're about 20 years apart. So he really held on to that concept.
You stick with what you know.
You know, Down or The Shaft, whatever you want to call it, is probably best known for having a pre-stardom Naomi Watts as the lead in it. That's probably around the time she got famous for The Ring and King Kong.
It was a year or two before The Ring. That's right.
Yep, around the time, like around the mid part of the. Of the 2000s, she made its way to a lot of cable movie networks, partly, I think, on the basis of, oh, we've got this cheap film of Naomi Watts. I've never seen The Lift. I've seen Down because it was, you know, ever present on, like, Showtime or Cinemax, whatever networks. But The Lift is probably most famous for its tagline, take the stairs, for God's sake, take the stairs.
Oh man, I wish I came up with that one.
It's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. So a couple of killer elevator movies to check out this coming week. We have a few more. For instance, Joel, you mentioned pre-show that G-Kids is putting out a couple of individual Miyazaki releases this week.
Yep. Weird timing because it's Halloween, but I'd imagine it's to get them out there in time for Christmas shopping. They've got this week Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind, and they've got Castle in the Sky. Both of which are just, I mean, it's Miyazaki. They're just beautiful, phenomenal films. Absolutely worth looking into. If you haven't seen them, they're fairly inexpensive on Amazon. The MSRP on like specialty anime Blu-rays tends to be high, but Amazon's got them around the $15 mark. So they're absolutely worth looking into. Even buying sight unseen, if I had to like. Tell you one or two movies this week to buy without having seen them, these are the obvious choices for me. So, you know, if you've ever felt like dipping into Japanese animation, or just like lesser known non-Disney animation, although Disney at one point did have the rights to release the Studio Ghibli's films for a good long time. I think G-Kids now has the rights to, if not all of them, most of them, because I think a couple of weeks ago they put out Princess Mononoke, and I think recently they've released just about all of them. Mostly this month. We've been remiss in missing them. I think a few weeks ago they put out Mononoke, Spirited Away, Howl's Moving Castle, My Neighbor Totoro, Kiki's Delivery Service. You can shut me up whenever, Chris, because I will not stop talking about these.
Well, I was just gonna say that if you've got kids and you want to raise them to be hipsters, then you just show them Miyazaki rather than
you gotta
Disney
ruin it like
there.
That.
That's a compliment.
How is that a compliment? How close are you to Austin?
I'm about 2 hours, about 100 miles. But no, I'm a self-professed hipster myself, so this is probably something I would show my own kids if I had any, but I don't have any. So.
With your anti-Netflix stance.
Exactly. And we'll move on. And we'll take a look. Scream Factory's coming out with... Now this was a double movie set, right? Dawn of the Dead and Land of the Dead.
No, these are separate. They're both collectors.
They are separate.
Editions.
Okay. All right.
Yep.
This is the 2004 remake of Dawn of the Dead, and then the follow up Land of the Dead with an awesome Dennis Hopper in that. Am I correct?
Oh yeah, Land of the Dead. I think the whole cast is phenomenal. I'm a huge fan of it personally. I think reaction to it from horror fans is mixed, leaning towards positive. But I think it's, you know, really exceptional entry into Romero's catalog. The cast is great. I mean, John Leguizamo's really fantastic. Of course, Dennis Hopper is unforgettable. I think Robert Joy is Charlie, who is, you know, despite being in a horror film, one of the most thoughtful depictions of a mentally disabled man I've ever seen in a movie.
Yeah.
Completely without sentimentality or without condescension. It's just a fantastic role. Robert Joy is so good in everything. And the whole cast is good. It's a really excellent film. It's probably, I would say, the least Romero of Romero's movies. I mean, I guess I'm not counting like later ones like Diary of the Dead, you know, just sort of the ones he pumped out just because he's Romero and he seems to have felt obligated to pump out zombie films.
Right.
But, you know, if Day of the Dead is the most Romero-ish of like his zombie films, this is probably the least so. And it's probably the most hopeful, most optimistic of the ones he ever released.
Yeah. And of course, with the Dawn of the Dead remake, I actually, I don't enjoy many remakes or reboots or whatever the case is, but the 2004 remake of Dawn of the Dead was quite excellent. I did enjoy that quite a bit.
Yeah, I thought it's a shame that Zack Snyder became so one-note in his directing, because there's some missteps in this movie, but, you know, there was a lot of promise. I mean, of course, here's another case where you've got a very good cast. You know, I mean, I think casual viewers will probably most recognize Ty Burrell from Modern Family.
He's awesome. He's awesome in Dawn of the Dead. Just straight up asshole. Just, you know.
He's the dickhead of all dickheads.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I kind of like how he was trying to redeem himself there towards the end. And he went out in kind of heroic fashion, but you know, just straight up dick in the entire movie, man. It was just awesome to watch.
Yeah, you've got Ving Rhames, you've got Sarah Polley, who's a wonderful independent actress who's largely kept herself, despite being very successful, kept herself to the indie scene, which I find interesting. But yeah, it's, you know, got, of course, you've got Matt Frewer in a small role. Yeah, there are some missteps, like that whole zombie baby scene is just tonally a mess. But for the most part, the film works very very well. The cast is all interesting. They've got a lot of a lot of chemistry together. There's a lot of there's just a lot of great interactions between the cast members. The directing's very good. Again, it's really a shame that Zack Snyder became so boring in one note.
So hacky.
In his later film. He became such a hack.
Such a hack. Yeah. All right, so, and then we've got another interesting one here, a Wes Craven TV movie from Doppelganger called Summer of Fear.
Yeah, this is actually one released a couple weeks ago. That we missed out on.
And that's why we're mentioning it now.
Yeah, it's you know, I think it got pushed back a couple weeks here and there, and that's why we missed it. But so Wes Craven TV movie with Linda Blair that seems to be, I haven't seen it yet. I really want to, but seems to be her she's becoming convinced her cousin that moves in is a witch. And it's based on a, I mean, it's probably going to be very, like, young adult. It's based on a Lois Duncan novel, the writer of I Know What You Did Last Summer.
Yeah, okay.
So, this is an interesting little curiosity. You know, it's got some fairly, Linda Blair is obviously the biggest name, but it's got some fairly well-traveled TV actors, including Fran Drescher in a small role.
Yeah.
But I'm curious about this, and I'll probably pick it up at some point because it's Wes Craven, and it's just sort of a curio that you'd think, considering Craven directing Linda Blair, might have gotten more attention, but But it seems like an interesting little entry into the TV movie era.
Yeah, okay, very good. And then we want to make mention, we talked about in our new releases last week, we mentioned JD's Revenge. But the release date's been pushed back to November the 14th, unfortunately. So I guess we were a month too early on that. I guess this pushback date was last minute. And so, unfortunately, Joel, you're going to have to wait another few weeks to pick
that up. I know. And, yeah, that tends to happen to Arrow releases. It just because I'd imagine part of that is them being a UK-based company, so distribution might take a little longer for the longer for them in terms of their American releases. But you know, they're never they never seem like later than like a couple of weeks on the on their Blu-rays. So, and they're always worth it. Arrow releases wonderful stuff, great cover art, great special features, great prints. They're just a great company, and this is absolutely a film I would recommend to anyone curious about blaxploitation, about, you know, sort of overlooked horror. It's just a really fun movie.
Yeah, it is. Great stuff. All right, Joel. So those are your new releases for this week, October 31st, Halloween. So instead of buying candy for the kids, go out and buy yourself some Blu-rays and just, you know, tell the kids to take a hike or whatever.
You buy some candy for yourselves, dude.
So we got some movie talk to do now. We're going to go into the witch realm here a little bit. We don't talk about witch movies very often. But we've got a couple of good ones. And the first one we want to talk about is Mario Bava's Black Sunday from 1960. Now, I saw this film under the alternate title, Mask of Satan. But it's the same movie. I made sure I was watching the same movie. Basically, we've got the premise is a woman accused of witchcraft is put to death in the beginning of the film. Centuries later, let me go back a little bit. She puts a curse on it's her own brother who puts her to death, and she puts a curse on his descendants. And then we go centuries later. She's being revived through, of course, an accident involving blood, as it usually is the case. And we, and basically the plot runs amok with, just lots of doom and gloom for various characters throughout the film. So, I mean, I've done a poor job of summarizing the film, but basically you get the gist of it. It's Mario Bava, of course, the famed Italian director. And this was his big directorial debut, and I think it was quite controversial as well, because it's 1960, and there are some standards in place in films during this time period, and what we have here is a case of a lot of gore, some violence that may have been deemed too extreme for that time period. There was a lot of criticism towards it, and I think really, Joel, it probably helped really spread the word about this film in the beginning. So I want to ask you, with this being Bava's debut, how does Black Sunday stand up to the rest of his filmography?
Oh, well, you know, I should say that Bava did stand in as director in a couple of other films beforehand. I think basically finishing some films for directors who had left projects. I mean,
that's right, but this really is his first baby, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, he was well traveled as a cinematographer, of course. He's not like inexperienced at this point, but this is his first, I guess, the first film that's fully Bava's vision, really. Yeah. And I mean, certainly there's a level where it doesn't totally feel like Bava yet, where it feels like very informed by, universal horror. Like, this is definitely a great bridge. I mean, even though it was about a year after Horror of Dracula by Hammer, definitely feels like a great bridge between the universal era and the updated gothic horror era that Hammer and Amicus, like, stand in for. And yeah, of course, absolutely. It's not the first Italian horror film. That would be that's generally considered to be I Vampiri, which Baba also co-directed and was cinematographer for. But yeah, it's definitely like this is the film that launched Italian horror, and for good reason, and was extremely popular in America as well. Partly because it got picked up by American International, put on a double bill with Little Shop of Horrors. Yeah. Although this was the header film, Little Shop was basically tacked on because they really were having trouble getting distribution for that one. Sam Arkoff bought the rights to distribute this for like $100,000, which was more than the budget of the film itself.
Oh yeah,
it was just a phenomenal success, which I find really interesting because especially its American success, because it's such a 180 from the B movies that were popular in America in the 50s. I mean, the era of radioactive science is like totally dead by this point.
Oh yeah, I mean, at this point, 1960s. So Psycho, Hitchcock's Psycho, comes out around this time, and I think. And in terms of American horror, that really started to change the tone, so to speak. And with Black Sunday coming over, I mean, that really fit more along the lines of that tone that Psycho was trying to adapt. And I think it was just a change of pace for American audiences, and that's where the interest came from.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, it was a revival of a style I think people were used to. I mean, we're in the television era now, and Universal era horror films are being played fairly frequently on TV. So it's a style people are used to, but it's a modernization of the style, even though it's still being set in historical eras, like, I mean, typically in medieval Europe or later in Victoria. This is based, Black Sunday is inspired by Nikolai Gogol short story, it's V or Vi, I'm not really sure how to say it.
I was looking at that. I would have pronounced it Vi myself.
Yeah, and which is a fairly famous story from a really well-renowned and strange Russian writer, but yeah, like you take a style people are used to with gothic horror, and then but modernize it with a lot of conventions that are either more modern or just haven't been seen before. It's extremely gruesome. It ran into censorship problems in the UK, of course. It was banned.
Oh, yeah. It was banned there until like the late 60s, at least. It was at least 8 or 9 years before they showed it in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, American International cut it a bit before releasing it in the US. So you've got a level of intensity and a level of gruesomeness that people hadn't seen before, which was already a novelty. And of course, you know, for younger audiences would have been, is, you know, really taboo and exciting. You've got that great double casting of Barbara Steele has Katya, Princess Asa, the witch from the 1600s, yeah. and Katya, the young noblewoman from the present of the story. So you've got that double casting where you've got not only a beautiful and really, really distinctive actress with an intense face, intense gaze, like, you know, she's beautiful. She's got like she's very sexualized, but at the same time, she's very fierce. Like, it's just a female lead, I think, of a type that people weren't used to seeing. I mean, maybe in the 40s during the film noir era with with a lot of the femme fatale characters, with actresses like Lauren Bacall, but not quite to this extent, or this kind of scenario, and you know that kind of archetype hadn't really been seen for most of the 50s. So it's for most of the post-war era, really. I mean, you had film noir in the 50s, but I think it had pretty much tapered off by this point.
Yeah. Well, let's hit on a couple of the plot elements here real quick, because one of the first things right out of the gate, within the first few minutes of the film, we have one of the more controversial scenes in the film. So we start off in, I guess, roughly 1630. So we're in the 17th century here. And the witch Asa and Javudo, I guess her lover, I guess, at the time, are sentenced to death for sorcery by her own brother. And so not only is she going to be burned at the stake, but they've got this mask. I guess they call it the Mask of Satan, that they're going to put over her face. But it's got these spikes on the inside of it, and they literally show them hammering with this huge, like, you know, hammer about the size of the thing that you would use at the sideshow to, you know, hit the bell. And this big, huge dude hammers this thing into Asa's face, and that was like, I mean, for 1960, man, this thing is, that's quite graphic for the time period.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's an intense scene. It's not just that it's bloody, but that it's so vicious. Really remarkable, intense stuff. And it's also happening, like, right in front of you to a female character, which is already, like, there's so many, like, mid-century movie taboos being broken in that one scene alone, and it's the beginning of the film. Like, and also sort of undercuts in a very pointed way the morality of the film, because I mean, they're unambiguously Katja and her lover, Princess Asa and her lover, ambiguously, they're sorcerers. I mean, they're absolutely guilty of what they're being accused of, but there is an element of evil to them, although we don't really see evidence of that before the conviction. We see evidence of that later, like after their rebirth. But yeah, like, you know, the fact that they're being put to death in this vicious way, I mean, it does undercut a lot of assumptions in horror films about, you know, the level of morality of our heroic characters. I mean, it's her brother's condemning her to death, and in like this, it's not like they cut her head off like in a guillotine. Like, this is an extremely cruel way to die, and it puts us on really shaky moral ground, which is interesting.
Yeah, definitely. So you've got that one scene, and then of course, you know, before she dies, she places the curse on her brother's descendants, and so we get flash forward 2 centuries later, as the graphic tells us. So now we're in, like, the 19th century, I guess, mid-19th century. And we've got Dr. Cruvillon, played by Andrea Cechi, and his assistant, Dr. Gorobek, who's played by John Richardson. Going through the country, Moldavia, which I believe is some Eastern European, maybe even Russian country, based on, you know, the names. And, of course, it's based on the Russian story, as we said in the beginning. So they're en route to a medical conference. Their carriage breaks down, and while they're waiting for it to be repaired, they stumble upon the crypt where Oz is buried. And Cruvillon chases after a bat that's trying to attack him, and he accidentally smashes the glass in the tomb, and he bleeds from the cut, and blood drips on the face of... they remove the mask, first of all, and You can just actually see the puncture wounds on her face. And so, but of course, he bleeds from a cut, and it drips on her face, and that starts to revive her. Now, the whole revival process in the beginning part of this is kind of grotesque as well. I mean, flesh is starting to return. Her eyeballs are starting to reform. And there's something else that was kind of grotesque for the time period.
Oh, it's absolutely gruesome, and wonderfully so. I mean, even before she starts reviving, we get this scene of scorpions crawling out of her, like, corpse's eyeballs, eye holes. It just, if we're an audience in 1960, this must have been, like, absolutely stomach-churning. It's just amazing stuff. And, you know, I'm not really a gore hound like a lot of there's a lot of horror movie fans who are, but I probably was more as a kid because just being amazed by special effects and being amazed by something that seemed very taboo. I mean, for me, the gore in this, I think partly interests me because it's at such interesting odds with that very gothic atmosphere. It works because, like, there's such, like, sensuality in this film. There's such, like, you know, intense gloom and shadow and, like, a lot, but at the same time, it's a film with a lot of, like, it's a film with a lot of intensity. It's not just, like, melancholic. So the gore is a really weird, like, intrusive element, and I like the way he takes these elements that don't perfectly match up and, like, pushes them into each other and to see what kind of effect it's going to bring out. I mean, there's no, like, you know, very classy discretion shocks like you get in, like, universal horror films where something bodily disgusting might be happening, but the camera's cutting away or it's shadowed or
right.
It's a silhouette.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is very forthcoming and blunt, so to speak, with the graphic details. And so this is really why it was controversial in the UK, just from those grotesque elements alone with the opening scene and then this scene as well of Asa reviving slowly with the goopy eyeballs, man. I don't know how else to describe it, man. It's just sort of kind of slimy inside her eye sockets, and then eventually her eyeballs form out of that, and it's kind of cool, and that they had the vision to complete that from a technical standpoint. It came out very well.
Yeah, I mean, it still holds up. I mean, part of that, I'm sure, is that it's a black and white film, and, you know, black and white helps disguise anything in the makeup effects that doesn't work after, after years of improving makeup effects. But yeah, like, one of the things that's really interesting to me is that, like, so, yeah, this is some of the most grotesque stuff in the film, and it's about revival and resurrection. Like, it's not typically, like, horror comes from taking the human form and distorting it or tearing it up, like, mutilating it, just making people feel like their body is being intruded in some way or, you know, endangered in some way. But this is someone coming back to life, and it's awful. It's a really fascinating take on body horror.
Yeah. So we've talked about that element of the film, the more controversial side of it. Let's talk about, in terms of the plot itself, how we feel about that. And I thought the plot, it was strong. Of course, it's your typical, it's a story that's been told many times before and has been told many times after about, you know, a curse being placed upon a family and, you know, centuries later feeling the effects of that. So it's a typical cursed family kind of plot element. But the atmosphere and the tone surrounding everything here, very well done. It's definitely creepy. The gothic tone and atmosphere surrounding it, the the locations or the staging, the production design, I want to say, instead. Very well done. It adds a lot to the plot. There are some slower moments in the film. And of course, there always has to be a plot slowdown at some point. But I think I think overall, there's just the tone was kept throughout the film. There was always that that haze of doom and gloom surrounding everything. And I think what we have here is just a very strongly plotted film, you know, taking a conventional story and just making it feel like something fresh.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, the story itself is so elemental and so straightforward. Like, it's not a film where the plot is really going to surprise you. I think the most surprising element is, and it's one that, like, you know is going to happen, but but the switch between that happens between you know, Asa and Katja, when Asa's back, like the confusion over who is really who. Yeah, I mean, you know, for like genre savvy viewers, you know that's going to happen, but it's done well. You know, the plot, like I said, is not surprising in this. It's more like the way the visual and tonal elements of this conflict is like where where a lot of the friction comes from, because it's such a, because the plot is so straightforward, it's such a mood piece.
Yeah, it is. It's a mood piece, and I really think the more gory elements of it really did heighten that as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it lends a certain instability to it, because if this were just like a melancholic gothic sort of, you know, sensual sort of romantic and like just sort of you know, a maybe oppressively gloomy film, it would be good because of Bava's mastery of tone and form. But yeah, the gore in a rare case actually does add something to the tone, because it undercuts like everything around it. I mean, you know, it's this very sort of, they're in a rural area, but it's still a very sort of formalized society, and the gore reminds you what's underneath all that. Like, literally, the society is built on all these old horrors, and you know, that's a classic horror theme, of course, that like, yeah, the comfort of the present is just kind of built on the bones of the past, and that's what's happening here. I mean, the tomb where Princess Asa's buried is, you know, complete ruins. They go down into it. It's horrifying. Like, you know, there's like an actual like glass window on her coffin, so people can view her, like, basically so they can see what she's guilty of, because she's got the mask of Satan on. And in no small amount of time, it's very quick, rational older doctor manages to smash this window, remove the mask, bleed on her face, and accidentally destroy the cross that's built over the coffin to be looking down on her to keep her her powerless within the coffin. Like, he destroys every measure of protection in like 3 minutes.
Ah, yeah, he totally screwed everything up, man.
Oh my god!
And he was a doctor. I wouldn't want him operating on me.
They're on their way. He's a renowned doctor. They're on their way to like a big conference. Like, and that's the, and of course that's classic horror. Like, you know, rational scientific men coming across something that can't be explained with rationality.
I guess he attended the same medical school as Dr. Domeno.
Like, oh my god. Like, what amazes me is that, you know, when he pulls off the mask, like, she's not totally desiccated. Like, I mean, she's not in great shape, but her flesh is still there, which you would not think after, you know, hundreds of years, however long it's been. She should be totally a skeleton by this point. She's not. Like, how is a doctor not seeing this? Something's wrong here.
Yeah. So, talk about the plot. We'll talk about Bava's, some of the technical aspects of the film, courtesy of Bava. I mean, we've got, of course, it is filmed in black and white, and it's done, and this is the time, you know, where movies were leaning more towards color. But I think the black and white, of course, enhances pretty much everything in this movie. And the cinematography by the cinematographer in this film was Bava did his own cinematography. That's right. So what we've got here is the cinematography from Bava himself. It's just very. There's a lot of ingenuity in there, and enough flair it really added a lot to the tension in some of the scenes in the film. And I just thought it was brilliant and very ghostly looking throughout the film.
Oh my god, yeah. I mean, there's some really it does some really fascinating stuff with cinematography. I mean, there's plenty of course, close, oppressive shots, very claustrophobic shots. I think one of my favorite moments in the cinematography in this film is just there's a scene where the younger doctor, Andre Gorobec, is just walking into like sort of the main room of Katja's manor, and there's this wonderful like 3-point perspective thing going on where there's an overhanging like low ceiling right in front of the entrance, and then you get these two major like points of the wall on either side, just this really weird triangular thing he achieves with that shot that's just absolutely stunning, and it's so intense, and it's just a guy standing in front of the entrance of the room.
Yeah, exactly. I know what scene you're talking about, and that was a brilliantly filmed scene, and definitely considering that this was, you know, Bava's first major pick, it definitely was predictory of, you know, the talent that he has and what was to come from him in terms of the rest of his career.
Oh, absolutely. Like, everything, like, you know, like I said, it's more informed by, like, older films than Bava would later be. I mean, yeah, I think the first film of his that, like, is really just pure Bava all the way throughout is probably, like, Kill Baby Kill. Yeah. You might even say that, like, I can even see an argument like that, like, Planet of the Vampires is like a pure Bava throughout, but I think he like hits exactly what he wants to do with Kill Baby Kill. But yeah, no, I mean, there's some absolutely wonderful stuff here. It's just perfect mastery of tone and mood. And like I said, like the ability to take elements that traditionally did not go together and put them together. I mean, yeah, I know this is based on like a Gogol story, which I really need to read at some point. But you know, it looks like it could be for anyone who loves old horror fiction, a Ray Russell story. Like,
yeah,
for the way he took like gothic conventions and added that like very open. Those very openly bodily elements, the gore and sexuality, the way that seems to sort of undercut the tropes and the pretensions of the gothic mood. Like, that's very much on display here. It makes me wish we had gotten Bava doing some kind of Ray Russell adaptation. But I mean, you know, this is like, this is right at the time where Russell's writing his where he's starting his career and writing his most famous stories. So it's interesting to see that sort of in the air in both like literary horror fiction and in horror films at the same time.
Yeah, definitely. We'll talk about the cast real quick. You already mentioned Barbara Steele, the main character, because she plays a dual role with Asa, the witch, and her descendant, Katya. John Richardson as Gorobec, Andre Gorobec. A solid lead action hero type character. You know, playing a young doctor, he's smitten with Katya, and of course he tries to save the day in the end. No complaints with his performance, just the typical, you know, white bread hero performance. Andrea Cechi as Dr. Cruvion, the guy who screwed everything up.
Yeah.
He would, and kind of a dual performance from him as well, because of course he's playing the straight-laced doctor in the beginning, but then he becomes kind of like a henchman, so to speak, as he comes under the spell. So kind of like a double-sided performance from him, and I thought it came off pretty good. And in terms of the cast itself, I don't have any complaints. I mean, of course, the version I saw, of course, was dubbed, but that didn't really take anything away. And yeah, you could see the performances coming out, and these were all strong performances from the cast.
Yeah, I mean, the performances do pretty much exactly what they need to do. I think the only performance to me that really stands out as excellent is Barbara Steele.
Yeah.
Like, and you know, even so, like, you know, there's a lot of gothic conventions that I don't know if they're being undercut so much, like sometimes where, you know, watching it, it's like, oh god, Katya just fainted again. And there's part of me that just thinks, yeah, it's undercutting those conventions because that's what allows like Asa to pretend she's Katya. I mean, you know, you've got like white bread hero, but I mean, to his credit, like his big like heroic moment is not like a lot of these films, like they'll try to give like the white bread hero like a big like swashbuckling moment to look cool, and his moment is just like being observant enough to notice exactly what's wrong and what the truth is. And yeah, I thought that like absolutely worked well, because he's a young intelligent doctor that should be what he's doing. And like, that's also like, it's not so, like a lot of gothic horror, like that's not something that happens. Usually the hero is just like heroic by acting at the right time, or by like being so pure that horror can't corrupt him. Like, but here it's just, he's intelligent and rational and sees what's wrong. I like that.
Yeah. It's more of a passive aggressive kind of hero rather than, you know, like a diehard kind of hero. So yeah, definitely. An understated, I guess, heroic performance from Richardson there. All right. Well, Joel, you have anything else to add before we get to whether or not you recommend the film, which I think I know where you're going.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I absolutely recommend it, of course. And, you know, there's different cuts out there because AIP cut it down. Like, the soundtrack's different on different cuts. But, you know, even, like, the cut versions, I think, like, this thing's, you know, you look around, like, online if you're just trying to watch it to get a sense of what it's all about. Like, even the cut versions with the redubbing, like, which is not bad, partly because most of the cast is already, like, spoken in done their lines in English to begin with. But, you know, even, like, and adulterated version is still a worthy horror film. It's just, it's, you know, a wonderful sense of tone and place, like a great mix of different elements in a way that I think just for a film that's fairly straightforward, like, you know, it's a film that's more a mood piece than a plot-oriented film. Like, there's still a lot of conflicting elements. And, you know, it's just, there's a great level of control. I mean, sometimes Bava can be so controlled, he feels a little dour. I tend to feel that in a lot of his, like, earlier color stuff, like, you know, something like Blood and Black Lace or something. Which is weird, because, like, he's more suggestive and more, like, moody and sensual in like this black and white gothic film than he is in some of the films where, like, you know, hot Italian models are being killed. sometimes just being hamstrung by your the area you're setting a film in, or by, like, you know, the limitations of certain types of photography, sometimes that just adds more pressure. Bava, like, yeah, he's got, it's a film where his, you know, level of control is being directed the right way instead of just seeming kind of humorless. It's a film that's, like, compelling enough where, as serious as it is, you're buying it the whole way through.
Absolutely. I like the fact that, like you mentioned earlier, it's kind of bridging the gap between Universal and Hammer. And, if you're a fan of, Universal or Hammer films, this is a film that you need to check out. It's got the same type of tone, the black and white cinematography, the atmosphere, it's all there from, like, the Universal era to the Hammer era. It's all there, with a couple of Bava touches to it in terms of the more, you know, graphic scenes involved here. So and a strong, you know, the cast does what they're supposed to do, and basically, this is a solid recommendation in the horror genre, and I'm going to put it up there as probably Bava's strongest film.
Yeah, it's a well-regarded classic, and deservedly so. I'd say my favorite Bava is still Kill Baby Kill, but this is very close. And, yeah, like, his imagery is just spot on. Like, there's such... it's moody and gloomy, but it's horrific, and it's very sexualized in a way that's uncomfortable and also hypnotic. It's just, like, he's got the tone exactly right on this kind of film, and to an extent that very few other directors have been able to, like, you know, compare. Yeah,
absolutely. All right. Very good. So there you go. Black Sunday. Double recommendation from Chris and Joel here at Go Home in the Box. With that said, we're going to take a break. And when we come back on the other side, we are going to follow up Black Sunday with a more recent film from 2015. We're going to talk about The Witch. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
Still in it. Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Clotheslines and Headlines, Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA On Demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey and Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apoitas podcast, The Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
Welcome back. In the first half of the show, we talked about Mario Bava's Black Sunday. So now it's time for the second part of the show. We're going to follow up Black Sunday with a more recent film, 2015's The Witch, directed by Robert Eggers. This was his directorial debut.
Yeah.
Cast includes not some very well-known names, but... we've got a few that might be well-known here very soon. We've got Anya Taylor-Joy, Ralph Ineson, Kate Dickey. Basically, the premise of The Witch, a Puritan family encountering forces of evil in the woods beyond their New England farm. And basically, this takes place during, you know, the 17th century, the mid-17th century. You had the Salem witch trials, and there was a lot of fear of witchcraft during this era. So we're looking at that era here, the Puritans, fresh off the boat, literally. We've got a family who decides to leave the plantation and build a farm by the edge of the woods in a secluded area. And, of course, that's when stuff goes down. You have an infant son that disappears during a game of peekaboo, no less. The little boy disappeared very quickly. And, of course, a very untimely end for that child is assumed through some scenes in the film. You kind of, if you're sensitive to that sort of thing, it might be a little hard to watch. Now, I don't have children myself, per se, but anyone with children might have a hard time dealing with the few opening moments of the film. But looking at some of the other aspects of the film, it premiered at Sundance back in 2015. It was widely released February 2016. So it took a while to get a wide distribution, but eventually it did. Budgeted around $4 million, and it made $40 million. So that would be considered a success for The Witch. Joel, let's talk about The Witch a little bit. Your first impressions.
Yeah, well, you know, this is one I actually saw in theater. The wide release was so successful, it even made its way to Utica, New York.
Utica? They got a movie theater in Utica?
No, they have, well, near Utica. There used to be one in Utica, but now they're vaguely surrounding Utica. But The Witch, the wide release was extremely successful, especially, like, it is amazing to me. I mean, just the fact that, like, word of mouth spreads so strongly about this film is all quality, because it does things that, like, stylistically, the era it's set, the way it's filmed, the lack of really known actors, it's like none of these things are conducive to getting a film in theater. I mean, that's not necessarily, like, there are probably films with those elements that aren't good films, but this is an exceptional movie. And it's a movie it's a horror movie, but it's also sort of a psychological film about a family falling apart.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's a religious allegory. I mean, it's about religion, not just an allegory, but, like, there's a lot of layers to this film, which and there's a lot to discuss about. Like, with Black Sunday, it's very much a mood piece, and, you know, at a certain point, you just have to tell people, just go watch it and go experience the moodiness of it. Like,
exactly. It's more of a, like, a on a visual, visceral level.
Yeah, with The Witch, like, I mean, there's interesting stuff going on visually, but, like, there's so much to these characters, and also a lot is being asked of the audience. I mean, let's put this straight out. Like, you're asking the audience to accept puritanical characters, a dialogue that's, if not, like, exactly how people would have spoken in that era, I'm not
right,
sure, but,
yeah.
Like, it feels at least redolent of how, like, we hear that. Hear, like,
a lot of these and thous and thines in the dialogue.
Yeah, and it feels like there's never a point where it feels clunky. Like, that's a really big credit to the cast, especially because most of the cast is, like, I mean, you know, like, half this cast is kids.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, and they pull that off. That's astounding to me. But, yeah, so, like, and you're asking horror fans to accept a puritanical mindset, which is pretty amazing. I mean, horror by its nature is, like, a niche thing, even though it's, like, thriving at the box office. Like, serious horror fans, the kind who might be interested in this film, like, that's a niche audience, and it's one that by and large, is not very friendly to Christianity. Right. And I'm not saying that as a criticism. It's just after years of, like, Christian panic about horror films, and with a typical horror audience being kind of counterculture people in general, that's just naturally going to be the case.
Right, and for casual viewers of the film, yeah, it does require a little bit of patience as well.
It is a slow burn film. And, you know, it's not just for casual viewers, but I mean, there's a lot of horror fans, like, that are into extreme stuff, but I don't mean extreme in the way, like, August Underground films are extreme or Cannibal Holocaust. I just mean, like, you know, gore hounds or people who are into, like, really active films or, you know, horror comedies where crazy things are happening. Just films that don't let up. This is a film where there's a lot of intense scenes, a lot of intense family arguments, a lot of intense emotion, but it's a film where the pace is very gradually building.
Right, exactly. And let's get into just the plot just a little bit. Like, as we mentioned, it's 17th century New England, and we've got the head of the family, William, played by Ralph Ineson. Now, Ralph Ineson, just an aside, some people might know him as Dagmar Clefjaw in Game of Thrones, Amicus Caro in some of the Harry Potter films, and he was in the British version of the sitcom The Office. So he's got some, I guess, a little bit of a fantasy film background going for him here. But anyway, he plays William, the head of the family, and they're basically banished from a plantation because of a difference in interpreting the New Testament. So they leave the plantation and they build their farm. They find a secluded forest and they build their farm at the edge of it. And we get the scene where there's a newborn to the family, the wife, Catherine, played by Kate Dickey. She's also been in Game of Thrones. She played Lysa Arryn in Game of Thrones. For you Game of Thrones maniacs out there, we've got a few Game of Thrones ties to this one. Anyway, she gives birth to I guess it's the fifth child. There's the oldest daughter, Thomason. There's a younger son, Caleb. There's a couple of twins, Mercy and Jonas. And then baby Samuel is brought into the fold. And there's a scene where Thomason is playing peekaboo with Samuel, where she covers her eyes. And basically, within that one split second, the baby suddenly disappears. And they show, they actually show what happened. There's a witch hauling the baby through the woods, and she basically, mercifully, we're not shown her killing the baby, but we know what happened. Basically, she's using the baby's, blood to make an ointment to help her fly. And so, you know, in the first 15 minutes of the film, that happens, and so it's kind of unnerving. Because, of course, it's an infant, and, you know, it's kind of, you don't want to see an infant placed in danger like that. But it really sets the tone for the film, I guess, in terms of mood. It's a really dour tone throughout the film. And so that really heightens it up right there with that opening scene.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of shock scenes in this, like a lot of very strange, like strange imagery, like, but it's very sparing, like it's used very sparingly. So like when it happens, it's even more effective, but it's also sort of, it can be, in certain instances, like the scene with the baby, like very oblique, it'll cut away. It'll just give you the impression of what's going to happen. Maybe it'll give you an aftermath kind of thing. But yeah, it's very shadowed. It's done in a way that's. It's both like very harsh and also non-exploitative. Like it's still really effective and really unnerving, but it's not done in a way that's like going over the top, or nothing about it tonally feels like an off note, which right. is really impressive with some of the very strange scenes in this. The opening is the father like willingly being cast out of, you know, their plantation because he feels like become corrupt. It's clear that he's like so arrogant that he thinks he's the only like
he's very very pious, very proud and pious head of the family there. He thinks that they're teaching the Bible wrong, and he wants no part of it, and so he willingly leaves with his family.
What impresses me regarding that character is that they give him enough vulnerable moments to make him fully like a three-dimensional character. He's not a character I don't think anybody's gonna like, but he has enough sadness, enough regret, like enough acknowledgement of his own mistakes to the point where like you can understand, you can have a level of sympathy for him, even knowing that like he's made this worse through all of this. I mean, he's set his family, you know, on a path towards obvious. If there wasn't a witch, like they'd be doomed, because there's so much of this film really is about like, you know, if you like metaphorically, it's about how civilization, how necessary civilization is. I mean, which seems like an obvious thing to say, but like America has such a strong like element of, you know, pioneer archetypes, you know, guys who go it alone, who, you know, have like bucked the system. They've rebelled against authority, like in all sorts of modes, and that like pioneer tales and like youth rebellion stories in the doctrine of like, you know, far right conservatism, libertarians, like, you know, doomsday preppers and survivalists. Like there's a lot of America is a huge and a country that was for years a wilderness in most of it. Like, so there's a lot of that element, because people who reject society are naturally drawn to a huge wild land where you could get lost in it and stake your own claim and be independent. So like if not a dominant, then at least a very enduring American myth in a lot of different ways, in a lot of different genres, a lot of different forms. And yeah, the witch is kind of a repudiation of that. I mean, you know, traditionally, like, we're so used to, like, looking at, like, Puritans and just kind of shaking our heads at their sternness and their rigidity. But then the witch undercuts that by giving us someone who's too Puritan for the Puritans. That rebellion does not necessarily mean you're, like, the cool free thinker or the progressive one. Sometimes it just means you're like a self-absorbed PS asshole who thinks you know better than everyone.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, I mean, getting back to after that first incident with the infant going missing, there's a little bit of a gap between incidents, and we get more of the struggles of a family. You know, there's inner turmoil because, you know, the mother, Catherine, thinks that Thomason knows more about the baby's disappearance than she's letting on, and then her father's silver cup goes missing, and she also blames the daughter, Thomason, for that. So there's a lot of inner turmoil in the workings, and like you said, this is one of the themes of this film is the breakdown of the family unit by outside influences. In a movie titled The Witch, you know witchcraft is always prevalent throughout the film in some form or fashion. You know, there's weird shit going on. So those are the outside influences that are seeping into this, what was thought to be a strong family unit because they were all on the same page with their faith. But all of a sudden, you know, it's starting to break down. And that's signified by the fact that various family members start to disappear. You got the son Caleb who goes off into the woods hunting and gets lost and is seduced by a witch, and he disappears, and when he returns he's naked and he goes into a coma, and of course, you know, spoiler alert if you haven't seen it, he's gonna die, but not before he spits up an apple, a whole apple. And the breakdown of the family unit, the breakdown is depicted by not just the inner turmoil, but, you know, the various family members go missing, and the outside influences, indirectly or directly responsible for this breakdown, of course, the witchcraft.
Yeah, and those outside influences, like, it almost doesn't matter that they're real, because, like, even the belief in those things, belief in witchcraft, like, it's, you know, and historical evidence has shown that, like, people really did, especially Puritans, but, you know, in general, a lot of people really did believe in the existence of witchcraft and blamed a lot of misfortunes on it. It's almost like it doesn't matter if the witch is real, because the outside influences, like these misfortunes they believe in, are just exacerbating their own like mistrust of each other or their own worst instincts. I mean, like all these things that like the, you know, eldest daughter Thomason is getting blamed for by her mother, like these are mostly things caused by her father or brother, in that they're doing things to help the family without letting the rest of the family know how bad a situation is. Like, their corn harvest is failing, like, which it's not clear if the witch is purposely blighting those crops or if the father just cannot, like,
he's a shitty farmer.
He's a shitty farmer. He's a shitty hunter. Like, Thomason even calls him out on this later in the film. It doesn't even matter if, like, a witch is blighting his crops, because he's just not good at this, at these necessary things.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you can be as pious as you want. You can live as monastic a lifestyle as you want. But if you can't, like, take care of yourself, then, like, your high-minded rhetoric and, like, you know, your ideals don't really mean that much.
Yeah, and you've got the one scene. There's a scene where the wife, Catherine, and William, her husband, are arguing, and you know, they're Puritans, so I mean, they fled England for fear of persecution for their religious beliefs and came to, you know, America. But there's a scene where, you know, they're arguing, and she says that she actually wants to go back to England. So, I mean, things get so bad that you want, because where the other side of the fence that you just fled from looks better. I mean, that's how far things break down for this family.
Yeah, and keep in mind that they've been in America so for such a slight amount of time that Thomason, like, and even Caleb, who's, you know, around 12, 13-ish, seems to be, like, they remember life in England.
Yeah.
So it hasn't been that long. Caleb remembers a bit less, and they argue about what they've really had. Like, they argue whether or not they had glass windows in their old house, which seems like the most impossible luxury when you see how they live now.
Yeah.
But yeah, like they've been in America for such a short amount of time that, you know, England is still a vivid memory they carry with them, not just like a distant, like vague thing. You know, it's kind of a remarkable like level of like moving through of different. They add so much texture to this family's existence because they move through different levels of poverty, different class levels, different like modes of living from, you know, what seems to be in England a bit more sustained, a bit more, you know, suburban is probably the wrong word. That's more of a modern word, but yeah, a bit more of a bit more of a domestic existence where, I mean, and they keep just moving down in the world from that to a plantation, which, you know, is, we see in the beginning, it's certainly probably comfortable, but it's definitely in the middle of the wilderness. We even see like some natives like near it, like walking into it as they're leaving, like presumably to trade with them, like to the point where they're just living on a farm, like on a farm at the edge of the woods and constantly imperiled just by the difficulties of farming and yeah, like making a life for yourself on the land.
And so, yeah, I mean, and then, of course, The Witch, of course, is being marketed as a horror film, which it is in certain respects, but within the context of the plot, not a lot of your typical horror stuff happens. I mean, it's spread out very well. We talked about the first incident with the infant Samuel. And then not a lot goes on until, you know, Caleb and his dog, of course, gets disemboweled, but Caleb disappears. And so we've kind of got, like, in terms of running time, we've kind of got, like, maybe a 30, 40-minute gap in between incidences. And most of it is devoted to, you know, the inner turmoil of the family as they start to fall apart and start casting blame on each other and, you know, whether or not they're still within the faith and everything, and there's a lot of, like, existential stuff going on in between. So it's just, as we mentioned in the beginning, the horror stuff is just very slow-moving. It comes to a head at the end, of course, but this, as we mentioned earlier, this actually, if you're a fan of horror as a genre, then you're going to have to exude quite a bit of patience for stuff to happen in this movie.
Yeah, and for me, like, the emotional pitch is so strong that, like, for a lot of viewers, I feel like that could be very overwhelming. Or, like, if you're not willing to accept, you don't have to be a Puritan, but you have to, like, understand the sincerity of their beliefs and their fears, like, to really understand why they're so on edge over this. And of course, you know, grief over losing a child is obviously a huge component, but, you know, the level of mistrust they exude is definitely born in their fears of the supernatural or, like, you know, the fact that their infant has been lost and their daughter was given the charge of protecting him. But, yeah, so, like, there's so much happening emotionally with this family and psychologically that, like, you know, I found it compelling, but a lot of people, either through the intensity of their interactions or just in sort of a difficulty of accessing the legitimacy of their feelings because it's built in a very old, like, very old beliefs. I mean, you know, not like Christianity, but the superstitious element that, like, became part of Christianity, especially in the Puritans, but in general through the Middle Ages and the colonial era.
Yeah.
So for a lot of people that might be difficult to accept. Personally, I found it really compelling. But yeah, there's a gap in horror, like, active horror elements to it, which I think works just fine, but some people might have an issue with. Now, as a brief digression, The Witch has sort of tentatively been placed in what, you know, some very high-minded critics are calling post-horror. For people unfamiliar with this term, and it's not even like Wikipedia certified as a subgenre now. stuff like A Ghost Story or It Comes at Night, which have like horror elements or like tense elements, or maybe some horror motifs, like, but aren't traditional horror films, are sort of getting classified into this. But there's a controversy in the horror scene as to whether or not it's a legitimate subgenre. I think assuming anything is post, like, which is always the dumbest, like, appellation in classifying genres. Post basically means, as David Thorpe on Something Awful once said, with all the fun taken out of it. but yeah, to me, like, something like A Ghost Story or It Comes at Night is a drama with horror elements. Like, The Witch to me is a straight up horror. I mean, I guess your probably closest comparison, I haven't seen, like, for a very good reason, don't watch Polanski films, but I imagine, like, based on what I understand about things like Repulsion or, you know, Rosemary's Baby or The Tenant, like, that sort of relentless psychological intensity and vulnerable female characters, that's probably a good comparison here. Yeah, so, like, the whole post-horror thing, usually means, like, hipsters making horror films. I don't think The Witch sometimes gets classified with that, but I think it's based on assumption that, like, genres are a fixed thing with one fixed definition, and to, like, claim that of a genre like horror films, that there are certain laws that govern all horror films, as, you know, as diverse as, like, you know, Ringu and Audition and The Witch and Friday the 13th and Halloween and Dracula and Black Sunday, like, you know, decades and decades of horror films with different takes on life and death and existence, with different genre tropes, with different styles. Like, to say it's one thing and now we have, and it's over, and now we have, like, a post genre. Like, it all seems very condescending. It seems like it's coming from critics that didn't really understand the appeal of horror films to begin with and are ready to reduce them to one thing in the service of these new films where Rooney Mara mopes and eats a pie for 5 minutes. So, you know, I don't want to get too off track with ranting, but The Witch has sort of been bundled in that kind of thing. But, I mean, you know, if you look at something like Eyes of Fire, and The Witch is very niche even within horror films. I mean, the closest obvious comparison, of course, is Eyes of Fire from 1981, I think, or thereabouts. But we don't really have too many period pieces in modern horror. We don't really have a lot of witchcraft films, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just that what witches do is so subtle and suggestive that, like, it's really hard to make a witchcraft film because so many other horror, like, archetypes are so have such, like such specific rules and visual motifs that it's easier to just make a vampire film or a zombie film.
Yeah, and I think the last film I saw with that involved witchcraft was a movie from the late 80s I saw called Spellbinder.
Oh, yeah.
Kelly Preston and Tim Daly. But I don't get to view movies like this very often. They don't really occur to me. So, yeah, other than you know, heaven forbid we mention Hocus Pocus, but you know, usually when someone's talking about seeing a witch movie, they're talking about that one or the 1991 with Angelica Houston, The Witches.
Yeah. The Witches, which is excellent. Or, you know, there's a lot of, you know, in the mid-century, there's a lot of, like, comedy fantasy films, like I Married a Witch or Bell Book and Candle, that have maybe a proto-feminist element to them. Yeah. I think that's part of the thing, is that witch narratives are always so much about, are always not necessarily about fear of woman, but about, like, feminine power, and in a sort of an era where as contentious as women's issues politically still are, like, an era where women are not openly subservient. Maybe the witch narrative has lost a bit of power, although it seems like that's not necessarily the case, because, I mean, in the protests that surrounded the inauguration and, you know, the ongoing Planned Parenthood protests, you're seeing a lot of signs of a lot of posts online using what's sort of become a mimetic phrase: "We are the granddaughters of the witches your ancestors couldn't burn." So it seems, and maybe like the use of witchcraft, like sort of has a feminist thing sort of fell by the wayside because of Wicca and because of like New Age spirituality. Feminism didn't really want to connect to stuff that was very heavily made fun of.
Yeah. That makes sense. So I think though, Joe, one more rumination I want to make on the, I guess, in terms of the story, the religious aspect of it. Basically, I think what the movie's trying to do is trying to make people, you know, understand what life would have been like for Christians if they were living in solitude. And of course, there's a lot of fear of God in this movie. Like we're talking about God-fearing Christians, and basically, you know, you got the character of William, who he wants to lead his family to be holy and so on and so forth, which is a good thing from their perspective. But the way he does it, I mean, it's more rooted in fear of going against the word rather than, you know, things like praying to have burdens lifted and things like that, and being joyous and for his mercy or whatever, you know, whatever Christians say. You know, I don't profess to be a Christian in any way, so, you know, I may be getting some of this wrong, but it's just they pray out of fear rather than anything else, and I guess that's something that the character William disagreed with at the plantation where they kicked him out, where I guess in his pious nature he didn't think that they were fearing God enough for his tastes, and so that's, I mean, basically there is a lot of fear running rampant through this family, fear of, you know, really going against any type of word of God.
Yeah, and there's a lot of fear of each other, but, you know, fear of what each other is capable of, fear of, like, how much they can trust each other. But, yeah, I mean, I think a big part of this film, like you're saying with the religious aspect, I didn't really get a sense really of how of the general mood of the plantation. I would have really liked a bit more of a sense of that, of, you know, how the plantation approached Christianity. I mean, we know they're Puritans, so there's a certain strictness, but, you know, part of what makes religious communities work is that there's a shared sense of belonging, of comfort from each other, and even though they're Puritans, of joy. I mean, one of the things about this is that, like, if you live a totally monastic lifestyle, like, you know, if your sense of religion is built just on fear, just on repercussion, you know, the joy, the potential sense of transcendence that might come from religious belief and faith is gone. Like, they don't have that to fall back on. There's some occasionally vulnerable or intimate moments between Will and his children, and mostly with Caleb, but a couple moments with Thomason. But yeah, I mean, there's such sternness and such lack of open expressive feeling, and, you know, it's sort of couched in, like, just hope God will deliver us, and, you know, pray for forgiveness. But yeah, there's none of, and, you know, this is still relevant today, I think. I mean, you know, there's I think there's still an element in Christianity. And of course, I'm Catholic, so the kind of method, the kind of Protestant Christianity exemplified here is not something I have really innate familiarity with. But I mean, you see that you see these kind of discussions among like fundamentalist Christians a lot, like, or, you know, born again Christians, like, at what, you know, what tenor your faith should take, basically. I mean, is, you know, like, even before, even, it's like Joel Osteen, let's say, even before, like, the, you know, hurricane controversy, and, like, you know, putting aside the money, the fact that his ministry is so rich, like, you know, if you if you've ever read his work or seen him quoted or anything, like, he has a very self-help tone to him. Like, it's almost like you're not really reading like a Christian doctrine. Like, he's very like generalized, very positive, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, but I do have some level of sympathy with people who look at that and wonder like where the Christianity is. But then there are people who look at that wondering where the Christianity is because it's not judgmental enough. Right. Because his writing is very positive and very like there's no sense of, and to an extent, like, my reaction is he's very positive, but it's a very shallow sort of positivity. It's not about like finding measures of grace and hope in difficulties and despair. I mean, it's not really about helping. It's not really about like the depths of charity you can like really reach towards. Like, I mean, a lot of Catholic doctrine is about that. It seems almost an egocentric Christianity to me.
Yeah.
And again, I'm no like real practitioner of anything. It's just someone with a spiritual sense that tends to I feel things strongly, but I'm not part of a church. But I also don't disregard the sense of community and belonging and comfort that a church can bring people.
Right.
And, you know, they've totally abdicated that and totally like abandoned that. And, you know, to the point, like, it's not healthy for one just in general for one family to live alone. I mean, we have indications that as Caleb is entering like puberty, has these like gaining set, like a sexual instinct.
Yes, we got to touch on that.
He's starting to very guiltily ogle his older sister. Of course he is. There's no other girls like near his age around.
Yeah, there ain't no other women.
Yeah, like, so I mean, it's either look at a particularly suggestively shaped shrub or like his you know young attractive sister. I mean, he's obviously feels very guilty and conflicted about it, partly I'm sure of religious guilt, but partly because it's a sister. But I mean,
yeah. And that's one of the things that the character Thompson gets into with her mother, Catherine. Her mother accuses her of bewitching, you know, Caleb in that sense. Towards the end of the film, when everything is really broken down, and so with that, I want to touch on a couple of other things real quick though, and we'll just talk about we'll switch gears real quick and talk about Robert Eggers. So first time director. This was he did a few short films before this, but I mean this was a big smashing success in his debut, you know, financially. And he had done short films for several years before this, and so The Witch is, you know, his first shot at the big time. And one of the things about this whole production, of course, was the authenticity of it all. There seemed to be a lot of like natural light and candlelight going on here, like, so we to give it more of like an authentic look, which was a good choice, I think, because it was a very minimalist picture to begin with, and the lighting in this film, being all natural or candlelight, was a very smart choice.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it adds to the mood. I mean, everything about this is so controlled and so committed to expressing the so committed to its mood, so committed to expressing the details of the era. I mean, the camera work is very long, still lingering shots. I mean, yeah. Internal shots almost have like an Ozu quality where, like, yeah, there's like moments where Thomasin's like kneeling over her work or something and the camera's low and it only moves when she stands up to follow her standing up, but it's still an absolutely still camera.
Yeah.
Which is a very Ozu tactic. We do get a lot of wider shots of the valley, but it's still almost a painting. I mean, you know, I would not be surprised if, like, Del Toro was an influence on him because of that very the exterior shots had that very painterly vibe that Del Toro has.
Yeah.
I would almost say that falls out a bit when you get into the interior shots, partly because, like, the interior of their households, whether it's because of their household and their barn, whether it's because of the low lighting or just because they're so impoverished, there's not much detail within it. And I think that might be purposeful to give it a sense of bleakness. And there's a lot of bleakness in this film.
Absolutely.
But yeah, it can be overwhelming because there's just, it's not like an Ozu film where you've got these still interior shots, but there's a level of comfortable domesticity around, or there's like a love, there's, you know, lighting on specific details that give it a very such a lived in atmosphere that you feel like you just feel like you're in the setting. I mean, there's such an almost nondescript element to the interior shots that I think is to illustrate how much of a hovel they live in. I'm pretty sure the mom actually calls it a hovel at one point.
Yeah.
It's almost a little too oppressively like empty. I just wanted a couple details here and there. Like, I would have loved, like, you know, early on in inside if we could have seen the silver cup, and then later, like, there's a shot where it's noticeably missing. Like, I don't necessarily need a shot where, like, the mom's like, oh, where's my goddamn cup? Like, but just a shot where, like, it's so conspicuous by its absence and the room looks that much worse for not having this one nice thing there.
Yeah.
Like, I would have loved that moment.
Yeah. You know, it's, so yeah, very, intentional, appropriate, minimalist approach. We want to give credit also to the cinematographer, Jaron Blaschke, working with Eggers on this one together. I mean, the overall look of the film is bleak. I mean, the weather, I mean, it's just very gray and overcast throughout the film, very muddy. So it's very, very depression causing, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no joy to be found in this family or in this film. And of course, given the tone and everything, that's intentional. So they really hammered the point home, I think, on a technical aspect.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we do get some moments of, like, some minor moments of joy or intimacy, like, or like early on, like, you know, moments between Thomas and Caleb, even like a bit of vulnerability, like, on William's part, like, confiding in Caleb. And Caleb, like, really, like, the film, like, he's sort of almost a decoy protagonist. The film changes so much when he leaves it, because he, more than his father, is holding his family together, which I found really interesting.
Yeah, yeah, the very, very good point to bring up there, yeah. And that was, of course, Harvey Scrimshaw, who plays Caleb. That was a very good performance from, I don't know if it was his age either, preteen, whatever, but that's a very strong performance there to mention.
No, he's asked to do a lot of very intense things, and he pulls it off so well. I mean, that can't have been an easy performance. I mean, it wouldn't have been for anyone, but particularly for someone his age. That seems like it was very difficult. Yeah.
And that brings another aspect. Let's talk about the cast real quick. Of course, at the top you've got Anya Taylor-Joy. Now, this was I guess is in essentially her debut. She had a couple of smaller roles in a couple of TV things I'm not familiar with. But after this, of course, she'd go on to star in the movie Morgan. I have not seen Morgan, but haven't heard good things about it. But she's in that. But she was also in Split, which I have seen, another great film, and she was good in that. So. I think we've got a solid young up and coming actress here in Anya Taylor-Joy.
Yeah, I mean, Split was an extremely successful film, another successful Blumhouse film, like we talked about with Happy Death Day last week. Yeah. And she's seems poised for a pretty successful career. She's in the New Mutants, the upcoming X-Men show, has one of the main cast, the one that has of course Maisie Williams from Game of Thrones as Wolfsbane, and Anya Taylor-Joy is playing Colossus's younger sister Ilyana Rasputin Magic, so she may be typecast. She may just be a witch forever now.
Yeah, let's hope not. Let's hope that she'll be choose her roles wisely and not get typecast. But yeah, this is strong performance here, and the whole cast is strong, right up down to the twins, Mercy and Jonas.
Oh, those little shits!
Yeah, they were.
Oh my gosh,
dude, they were so good, especially when it came to the taunting. It was very solid from up and down the cast, even though the child actors, like I said, and they were very good at portraying being fearful and. Everything that came with that. So I mean, to have them speak the language that they were, they opted to go with, I guess we'll call it authentic. We don't have much to go on that, but to have them, those child actors, able to pull off that style of language, it was very good.
Yeah, I mean, incredibly difficult performance. Like, incredibly difficult to hit that like pitch of emotional intensity. I mean, a lot was being asked of all those gigs, and they all pulled off very, very well.
Yeah, and what about and of course, I don't want to give too much away, but you also got to give credit to the GOAT, Black Phillip.
It, quite frankly, it kind of amazes me that like such a God-fearing family like even keeps around a black goat. just look at that thing. I think it looks cool, but like viewing it as a Puritan, my immediate thought would be, well, there's Lucifer, there's Satan right there.
Yeah, and so of course we want to talk about the end real quick, which was a huge twist, and probably the best scene in the entire film, of course, was the closing 10-15 minutes, it just pulled off so well. Consider everything that went on before. Finally, something happens, and. In terms of, we want to talk about your horror conventions. We finally get that kick into the gear near the end of the film, and it came off so well, considering everything that went before it. Like you said, a slow burn, and definitely had a very excellent payoff.
Oh yeah, like everything goes absolutely to hell. Yeah, I mean, if you want to sort of split this film up by acts, like, what happens to Caleb is like pretty much the definitive points of the film, where his disappearance basically leads to the second act, and his return and death leads to the third act. I mean, that's because he's the stable one of the family, despite being like 12, and he's the one holding it together. And you know, when he dies, and I should say, like, we've talked about, like, having to like access the emotions in this film to accept sort of a puritanical belief. Like, part of the reason the mom is so lost in grief and anger throughout this film is because her Samuel, the infant who disappears at the opening, is unbaptized, and because she's after Caleb dies, she's afraid he's going to hell as well as presumably the unbaptized baby.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, you have to look at that as well. So, I mean, everything, I really don't think there was an inauthentic moment in the, within the confines of the plot.
And, oh, absolutely.
And, yeah, and it's just, this is stuff that, you know, could very well have happened, even if there was no witchcraft, like you said, you know, even if there was, like, the story of a struggling, you know, Puritan family, and the baby died of cholera or something like that, you know, would have had the same result, you know?
Yeah. They're, like, as far as they can tell, like, their worst fears, I mean, you know, fear of witchcraft is prevalent, but, like, fear of their children dying without the ability to be accepted by God, like, that's their absolute nightmare. And that's what, like you said, there's not an inauthentic moment. Like, every emotion in this, like, even if it's sort of foreign to, like, a modern sensibility, like, everything is rendered so accurately and authentically that it's easy as long as you're willing to, like, as long as you're willing to accept the validity and sincerity of their beliefs, it's easy to like sympathize with them.
Right. Exactly. So, I guess I'll jump to the recommendation here, Joel, and I believe, yeah, this is a great film. I think, you know, the slowness of it is part of the whole story. The plot was very well structured. You do have to have some patience to sit through it. It pays off very well at the end. I really think it's more of a family drama with some horror elements strewn about. And strong work from the cast up and down. Robert Eggers in his directorial debut, very strong debut from him. Looking forward to seeing more from him down the road. And The Witch, a strong recommendation from myself.
Oh yeah, absolutely agree. Like, a strong recommendation. It's not a film that I would recommend to everyone. Like, there, yeah, I can think of certain friends, like, who just wouldn't respond to the film, whether through the pace or, you know, through, like, understanding where these characters are coming from, because it's such a different perspective on life. Like, there, it's not a film I would suggest to everybody, but to a certain sort of, like, to a certain, like, film goer, to, like,
oh, yeah. It's thought provoking. So this is, we'll call this an art house horror, and this isn't like if you're just a fan of, like, the slasher genres because of the awesome kills, then you're not going to like The Witch.
Yeah. No, I mean, to anybody who's really, like, willing to sort of do the emotional and, like, I say intellectual, but that sounds a little pretentious. It's just to do the work required to understand these characters and really empathize with them. Like, it's a really rewarding film with a lot of layers. But it's also, like, It's also one that is very bleak. It can be very relentless. Like, it's not fun. Like, it's not Night of the Creeps.
No, exactly. It's not a fun film, but it doesn't have to be. But it's definitely thought provoking and builds slowly to a climax that you won't easily forget.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. All right. So there you have it. Another enthusiastic recommendation from Chris and Joel for The Witch.
We really got to start mixing it up, talk about some real shit.
Yeah, we're going to have to get to some doozies that we can really trash, am I right?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, like Stranger Things.
Oh, okay. So you're going to go... I wasn't really going to
there's our entire viewer base for next week.
Yeah, I wasn't going to go down the Netflix road, but just on a side, I am so sick of people posting on Facebook that they're in the middle of Stranger Things 2.
Oh my god! Like I mean, if you've never seen a horror film and you're told and you want like sort of an introduction to the tropes of like 80s horror, like yeah, go watch Stranger Things or. Yeah. Or you could just watch Poltergeist and Gremlins or whatever. But,
exactly. Well,
What a waste of a great cast that show is.
There
you go. Bring it on, people.
Let's hit the music, Joel. I don't know. I got to come up with something. I keep saying that, but, you know, I got to actually dig and find some 60s game show music to tack onto this segment, Joel. Because it's time for Stump Joel.
Hey, in 20 years, we can go back to Stump Joel and do like some kind of nostalgic vaporwave remix of your Stump Joel theme.
Vaporwave. Trash wave. Yeah. Let's. So the topic this week, Joel, is since it's Halloween, this is the Halloween, I guess, edition of Go Home in the Box. They're all Halloween editions, but this is a very special Halloween edition.
This is even more Halloween than they usually are.
This is way more special than that special episode of Blossom.
Lies. Nothing is.
We're going to talk about masked killers, slasher movies with masked killers, you know, as if we haven't talked about slashers enough in the Stump Joel segment. But we'll come up with something different next week because this is Halloween. And... we want to hit on that and see if we can get Joel on any of these here. Premise is simple, 5 questions. No pressure. Just answer them. And if you don't know the answer, just say so. And I'll give you the answer. Because we're not going to leave the audience hanging when they want to know the answer themselves. So let's kick it off. The first question. From the town that dreaded sundown, the original version, not the remake. We try not to talk about remakes too much on this show. But the town that dreaded sundown, Joel, it's loosely based on an actual series of killings in what town?
Oh, Texarkana.
Texarkana, Texas. Ding, ding. Yeah, yes, sir, you got it. It's yeah, very loosely based, but there was an actual, you know, incident in Texarkana that a hooded figure, the Phantom Killer or whatever they called him, the series of murders, and then I think the story behind that is I think there was a woman who claimed it was her brother, and they actually busted him on like a car theft charge or something and sent him to prison, but. Yeah, the actual killer was never caught, and I guess he just decided to stop killing.
It's kind of a you know, southern rural version of the Zodiac killer. It's a really fascinating story. Surprised yeah. Well, I mean, it did get a remake. I'm surprised it hasn't gotten more attention, especially since you know, the Zodiac killer has been sort of ingrained in our culture, but. You know, there was that element of taunting the cops through the media. Like, it had a narrative to it.
Yeah. Exactly. So, so very good, Joel. You answered that question very quickly, too, I might add. So, I guess these are going to be softballs for you. Question number 2. Terror Train.
Ooh.
In Terror Train, of course, the killer wears many different costumes. But I guess the most prevalent one is the killer wears a mask based on what comedian?
Oh, Groucho. Groucho Marx.
Ding, ding. Man, these are just easy. I don't think they're gradually going to get difficult on you, Joel. I think they're all going to be softballs, man.
We might have to stay away from slasher films.
Question number three. In Prom Night, the original Prom Night, not the remake, this actress was set to play the lead role, later given to Jamie Lee Curtis. And who was the original actress?
Ooh, let me think.
And I think it's kind of appropriate that this actress was bumped in favor of someone else.
I am not entirely sure. Considering it's a prom thing, I'm gonna guess Sissy Spacek. Just shot in the dark.
Wrong. No, sir. Ooh. It was Eve Plum.
Wait, Jan Brady?
Jan Brady of the Brady Bunch. Yes, sir. And you Jan? See. And so, of course,
I get it now.
She was always jealous of her older sister, Marsha, getting all the attention. And Jamie Lee Curtis comes along and bumps poor old Eve Plum from the cast.
Oh, now as soon as she said kind of appropriate, my immediate thought was prom movie, Sissy Spacek. But no, oh, that would have been a weird film with Jan. It's not that she didn't do movies. It's just, I guess. I actually kind of would have liked to have seen her in some horror films. That would have been interesting.
So, all right. So we got y'all on one. Actually,
yeah.
All right. So you got him for 80% here. You got him for a B minus.
Mediocrity, here I come.
Question number four. You know what? You're probably going to get this one. Friday the 13th, Part 3. There's a scene where one of Jason's victims is reading a copy of Fangoria. And if you didn't blink and miss it, you would be able to see in that magazine that there's an article about whom?
Tom Savini.
Ding, ding. It is Tom Savini, the sly little devil himself. You know, the special effects master.
To be fair, we just watched Friday the 13th 3 like a week ago, and I was excited
and
to point
probably
out to Roxy.
Pointed it out, yeah.
Because that's what watching movies with me is like. My apologies to Roxy.
Well, then in that case, then you're probably going to get question number five, since you're the king of details such as those. Question number five, in Scream.
Scream.
During the party scene, what movie are the kids watching?
Oh, damn it. Hold on. I know I should know this. God, I haven't seen Scream in like 10 years, but I'm gonna guess Halloween.
Yeah, that is correct. Damn it.
Yeah.
That's correct. Yeah. Halloween is the answer. Of course, there's a lot of self-referential stuff, you know, between Wes Craven's Scream movies and then the later, I believe, in Halloween H2O, there's a scene where the kids are watching Scream 2. So it's kind of like giving it, the two franchises giving each other shout-outs there. So, yeah. Very good, Joel. 4 out of 5. Not too bad. You pass.
Foiled again by Jan Brady.
That does it for another round of Stump, Joel. Very, very easy round it was. I think it's time to... Maybe get into some obscure Eastern European, maybe Italian war movies or something.
talk about sad lesbian Rooney Mara films. I don't know anything about that, although, except that like all the women on Letterboxd seem to love her now.
maybe I'll ask you 5 questions about the movie War Bus or something. I don't know. Or the Bronx Executioner.
See, now I'm just going to have to brush up on my Bronx Executioner.
Very good, Joel. Very good discussion this week. Appreciate your time as always, sir. It was very informative, as always. And that's why you're the Ayatollah of pop culture. Because I'm not going to saddle myself with someone who doesn't know what the fuck they're talking about.
Yeah. That's what I'm here for.
Yeah, I'm riding your coattails, sir.
Yes.
Yes. So, for Joel LaPuma, myself, Chris Jordan, thank you for listening. And until next time, y'all take it easy. Enjoy yourself some movies. Unplug from Netflix. Get away from that Stranger Things. And find some good movies this weekend. So until the next show, we'll see you. Thank you.
Cast your scent quick and bite my lip and screw my